Anyway, thanks for coming in. Is this the last talk of the evening? Cool. All right. Well, hopefully you'll get something out of it. Can I get a show of hands on who's used dependency injection before? Holy cow. Why are you guys in here? All right. I'm going to go through quite a bit, and a lot of the stuff is an entry into dependency injection for those that haven't. Who has not used DI before? Raise your hands. Wow, very few. All right. Well, then I'll go quickly through that. But what I'm going to do is go through the start with the basics of DI just so I can set the groundwork, and then I'm going to jump into container usage, and hopefully that's where you're going to get a lot of your value, since most of you people in here have already used dependency injection. I'm going to go through details of DI and where the benefits are of using a container and what it helps you with. I'm going to be using one particular container. Obviously, I got to choose something, so I'm choosing AutoFac. Who's used AutoFac here? Quite a few. What about Castle? Ninject, structure map, MEF. Cool. All right. Well, good news is I got code samples for you in every single one of those containers. The bad news is I'm only going to show you them in one because I got a lot of stuff to go through, okay? So let's get started. And first, introduce myself. My name is Miguel Castro. Was anybody here in my talk on Tuesday? Cool. Well, thank you all for coming. Thank you for the good evals. I encourage everybody here to please fill out evals. It's a shame. I got well over 100 and something people in the room, but I've only gotten 22 evals, and it's kind of a low return. We do need this kind of feedback. That's the only way that I get invited back to awesome places like Barcelona. So if you like my talk, remember my name's Miguel Castro. If you don't like my talk, my name is Ricky Ricardo. So we're going to talk about classes, dependencies, and coupling, just the basics that a lot of people in here probably already know. But I want to stress a few points, a couple of specific points during this. And then I won't spend way too much time in it because it's probably too basic for a lot of you here. And then we're going to go a little bit of testing and explain exactly what DI is and what the container usage is. Because the container is the product. Dependency injection is the concept, and it's based on a concept called dependency inversion, or inversion of control, which is one of the SOLID principles, S-O-L-I-D. Who attended Chris Klug's presentation on Wednesday, yesterday? All right, good. Now, keep all that stuff in your minds, because I'm going to stay on the last part of it, which is the D. But Chris made a statement in that talk that was very important, and that is every letter in SOLID depends on the previous, builds upon the previous. And the last one is dependency injection or dependency inversion, which is the one that I'm going to stay on. But while I show you my demos, you're going to see, you may recognize elements of SOLI in there somewhere. Maybe not open-close principle, but definitely separation of concerns, a single responsibility principle, and definitely the Liskov substitution principle. So all of this stuff kind of blends together. I'm going to go over containers, and then we're going to go over some details of the container usage on stuff that they help you with, things like instance lifetime management, deterministic construction stuff, a little bit of the registration options that you get with different containers. Now, I want to say that every container so far does almost everything I'm going to show you. They just do it a little different. I ask you to bear with me because, like I said, I had to pick one container, and I happen to like AutoFac because it's the newer of the containers. It's got the nicest API, in my opinion. It was written in .NET 4, so it was written with all the new framework stuff in mind. But all the stuff I'm going to show you, for the most part, is available in Unity. It's available in Ninject and Castle. Just the syntax is different, and I'm not familiar with all of that syntax. I don't have time to learn every single container. I have to pick one just like you guys do and use it for my projects and my customers. And then at the end, I'm going to go over a couple of real-world usage scenarios. I'm going to show you some code, some projects of DI usage in four different applications: a desktop application, two web applications, and a WCF application. Who's a WCF developer in here? Okay, as am I. Wow, I love seeing that amount of hands. WCF's alive and well. Don't let anybody tell you that it's dead. Don't let anybody tell you that Web API is a replacement for it, because it's not. It's meant to be used in conjunction with it. Who here does ASP.NET web forms? All right. Have you used dependency injection in web forms? Anybody? I'm going to show you how. All right. I saw one person's hand go up. I want to acknowledge you. And of course, MVC, most people that use MVC use dependency injection. Get a show of hands there. Very cool. All All right, so the main thing here is to break a lifelong habit, and this is kind of one of those shock and awe statements. In Wednesday, when you saw Chris's talk, Chris actually made this statement that I'm going to make here as well. Chris is sitting in the front row, just so you know that I don't say anything about anybody behind their back. So if I insult him and offend him, the man is sitting right there. He's the bald guy filled with tattoos that look like he just got out of Leavenworth State Penitentiary in the United States, okay? So what is this lifelong habit? If I can get the clicker to work, I can tell you. Okay, so coupling is all about one class depending on another, okay? Now, we always have this. We have one class depending on another. It's how they depend and how they couple that makes our applications important. You can't write applications without some kind of coupling. The minute you say x equals 5, you've coupled something. The idea is to couple it correctly and to couple it loosely, not tightly. And I'm going to show you a quick example of a tight coupling and then break it up and do a loose coupling. The problem with tight coupling is that you're limiting, the problem is twofold. You're limiting functionality to a single implementation. So you don't get any benefit of polymorphism, but polymorphism is not even the main reason because we rarely use that today in most applications. The main thing is that we're limiting it to a single implementation, which means we can't test our classes. We can't write what is called testable software today. And the idea of writing testable software is it's got to be forefront in our minds when we write applications. The idea of writing testable software is not to tighten your software, not to couple your software to an implementation that can't be easily tested. If I have a class that hits some database stuff, how can I write a unit test against that class and one of its methods and not have it hit the database? If all that's hardwired into my class, I have no choice but to hit the database. And at that point, I haven't written a unit test. I've written something called an integration test. So testing becomes really difficult when you have this coupling. So how do we achieve this? What's the secret to writing testable software? In my opinion, it all comes down to one statement. Stop newing up objects in class. I believe yesterday you said if you're using equals new inside a method, you're probably doing it wrong. And I have to agree with that statement. Now, I get an audience of 500 people at this talk in Tech Ed USA in Houston a few months ago, and I asked the question, how many people have used dependency injection, and about 5 people raised their hands. That's actually a much better thing for me as a speaker because I can BS my way through the talk and everybody will believe me. But you guys are going to keep me on my toes. But when I say stop newing up objects in a class to a group of people that have never used DI, this is a shock and awe statement. Immediately the response is, what are you talking about? How the heck are we going to use a class when we can't new it up? And this is the secret to writing testable software. The second that you have a method that says, you know, var obj equals new something, right there you've just locked it in. And now anything that you call that method with, whether it's production code or testing code, a unit test, is going to new up that object. So the problem becomes very, very obvious here. What do we do to fix this problem? We embrace interfaces. With writing testable software, with writing solid code, the amount of code you write goes up. I think Chris proved that on Wednesday, and he actually made it a point to show you what he started with and what he ended with, and everybody here saw that. You end up with more classes. I'll take more stuff any day of the week as long as it's maintainable and as long as I can extend it later, and as long as I can test it. So we embrace interfaces, and yes, we end up with more CS files. There used to be a time when all we used interfaces for was polymorphism. Now I tend to use interfaces for just about everything. By separating the definition from the implementation, we can now have these classes depend on interfaces only. And now we can send different things into our classes. We can send one thing in production time, one thing in at testing time. It's actually a very simple concept. And by the way, you notice here at the end I have unit test can send in mocks. I lose a few seconds just because of the slow transition of the slides. Who's used a mocking framework before? They're pretty cool, aren't they? Who's used MockQ? All right, that's what I use, and that's what I'm using in one of the demos here. What about RhinoMox? Good product also. It's actually one of the first ones. There's one by Telerik called JessMock. That's a pretty good one. They all do the same thing. It's just like DI containers. They all do the same thing. Choose the one that you like. Choose the one you're comfortable with. They all have different APIs, so you can... So you can just use them a little differently, whichever API you like better. Excuse me. All right, so here's what I got. I got a very, very simple example. I don't want you to concentrate on like the business stuff of what this example does, because it's kind of trivial. I just want you to concentrate on the classes and the way I separate them out. I have a class called Commerce whose job it is to process an order. And there's many, many steps in e-commerce. So I broke it out into four very obvious steps. One of them is billing the customer, you know, with credit card information, that kind of thing. Updating customer records in the database with what product they bought. Notifying the customer through an email. And then logging stuff to, you know, logging database or XML file or whatever. The reason I chose these steps is because all of these steps have some pretty critical implementation that you need a production time, and implementation that you would not want to always be coupled to when you're loosely running the class from a unit test. Think of the billing processor. Its job is to process a credit card. And if I lock my class into it like this one is, if I instantiate the commerce class, I don't want to use the laser pointer because you can't see it anyway. If I instantiate the commerce class from a unit test right now and I call process order, as you can see, I'm completely locked into the implementation declared in line 11 of the billing processor. And the billing processor doesn't do much here. I mean, from my demo, all it does is write something out to the console line so you know that something took place. But in reality, that class would open up a payment gateway, something like PayPal, Authorize.net, Cybersource, whatever, and run a credit card through. Does that sound like something that you want in production time? Everybody nod. Your heads work. Does that sound like something you want at testing time? God help you if you do. And if you do want that, give me your credit card number, and I'll run my unit tests on this with your credit card. Well, the same thing goes for the customer processor. The customer processor updates the customer stuff in the database. The minute you're updating stuff in the database, you may be incrementing, you know, the unique identifier. Every time you run the unit tests, you're incrementing something or you're updating the databases. Not only is that bad, but you're also depending on outside resources. If that database is not running, you can't run your unit test. If the authorize.net or PayPal gateway is not running, you can't run your unit test. Think of the notifier processor. If I come back here, you got this notifier that is notifying the customer with a send receipt method. This is sending out an email. Imagine running a unit test on something like this. So this is my coupled example, and my coupled example sucks. It's really bad code. However, am I following any of the solid principles here? Raise your hand if you think I'm following at least one solid principle. And which one?
Yes.
Exactly right, the first one. I can't do the next without the first. So this is at least doing single responsibility, which is good. So I'm not 100% moron. I'm only an 80% moron. 20% has been eliminated by me following the S, right? So we're going to eliminate my moronship one letter at a time, right? Not in this case. So I do have single responsibility. I've broken things out. I don't have this one giant method that does all this stuff, so I can have reusability. But it's very, very tightly coupled. This is definitely not what I want. What I want is something like this. Look at this one. This is the same class. But as you can see, I'm not newing anything up. This is where my statement, stop newing up classes, comes in. I have these dependencies injected into the commerce class, hence the term dependency injection. Now, this one right here, if you don't know anything about DI, which is not the case in this room, and you get up and walk away, the best statement I can give you to take away from the session so far is that this is at minimum what you should be doing. Everything going forward is the aid of a product, is to get the instances of those dependencies to be resolved and to be instantiated easily so you don't have to do it manually. But if you don't do that, this is the minimum that you should be doing because this is decoupled code, and this is what allows it to be testable code using today's lingo. This is what I mean by writing testable code, because now in production, I can do the following. I can send it in like this. At testing, I can do the following. So those of you that use mock-Q will recognize this. But as you can see, I'm mocking up instances of each of the processors from lines 13 down to 24 or 23. And then I'm setting it up. Now, this setup is not really doing anything, but the cool thing about a mocking framework is that if it's done right, it's identical. The end result of using a mocking framework should be identical to writing a test implementation class. This is supposed to be the same as me writing another class that implements iBilling processor and implements whatever methods I want to test, because that's what I'm expecting to call from the commerce class. So with a good mocking framework, you set up a mock, and then you say, if you notice line 26 and 27, what I'm basically saying is, when the process payment is called on this, on the implementation that you're going to create for me on this class, and the following things are sent into it, return the following something, which in this case, I'm not returning anything. So that setup statement's just there for show. And once you got your mock all set up, basically, the mock billing dot object represents that test class that the mocking framework's creating for me. And that test class is not going to call a credit card processor. It's going to do whatever I told it to do in line 27 on the setup. It can choose to do nothing. It can maybe write something out to an XML file. You know, it can do whatever it is that you want. Good mocking frameworks let you do a lot more stuff in the setup, including full code snippets and everything. And now I can instantiate the commerce class and send the four test classes into it. But I didn't have to write these test classes. I let the mocking framework do it for me. So now I'm calling it with a mock of each of those classes, and I'm not really updating the database. I'm not calling the payment processor. I'm not sending out an email, and I'm not logging anything to a log file. I can successfully test the non-exception run execution of the process order method. So I can test that. I can test that it runs cleanly without exception, and not update all that other stuff. I will have a whole series of other unit tests that actually do call out to make sure that the database can be updated and that the payment processor can work. Those are separate tests. Those are integration tests, and each one's going to work a little different. Most payment gateways let you put the payment gateway into a test mode where you can run a mock credit card through, and it'll tell you the transaction completed or failed without actually charging anybody money. So those are very specific integration tests. I'm talking about plain and simple unit tests here. And all I did to decouple this is that I took my classes, like billing processor. Oops, wrong one. And I abstracted out the definition. That's all it is. The first criticism that I get from people that have never done this before is like, oh man, are you telling me you use interfaces for everything? Well, the answer to that question for me is pretty much yes. I do use interfaces for everything. They give me a lot of benefits. I don't mind writing the extra code. They let me do testability and decoupled code, and they also let me do multiple implementations if I wanted to later. Think about the idea of switching from PayPal to Cybersource or Authorize.net. Just write another class that implements that interface and plug it in later on. So that gets me to the plug it in later on. What do I mean by that? Obviously, something has to instantiate these classes. So we're still newing something up there, okay? Now, this is a very, very simple example. I have one hosting class. The commerce class is my hosting class. I have one hosting class with four dependencies. Now, does it make sense that perhaps the billing processor may one day require a dependency on its own? That's fine. Should it new it up, or should it inject it using an interface? Well, the answer to that question has already been answered by my previous spiel, which is you inject it as an interface, which means you now have another dependency at the next level down. So if that would be the case, I would need to instantiate that class somewhere here, correct? Now, is that a lot of code for us to write? It's not that big a deal, but what if we go yet another level deep? What about yet another level deep? It's perfectly plausible. It does happen. I mean, if you got 20, 30 levels deep, you probably got an entirely different problem on your hands. But three, four, five levels of dependency, I've seen it all the time. I've done it myself. I try, once I get to four, I try to make sure that I really need to go that far, but it does happen. But it becomes harder to manage at the instantiation level because now you need to backtrack. Now, any class that has a dependency, you have to know where that class is being called from. And then you have to know where that class is being called from. And you got to keep backtracking until the very beginning so then you can start adding crap here. You understand what I mean? And the more stuff you got to add here, the harder it is. Did I just say more harder? What kind of an American am I? The harder it is to follow and the harder it is to maintain. And this is where the aid of a container comes in. Any questions so far? Actually, I keep forgetting it's on two different machines. All right. So once again, I want to stress this is by no means a product pitch. I had to choose one container. I obviously chose the one that I happen to use. All of this stuff is going to work one way or another with any container that you choose. So DI is a pattern. It's an architectural pattern primarily designed to easily satisfy a class's dependencies. And that's that last problem we were trying to solve. We got our decoupledness set up already. And once again, I stress, the decoupledness of the code through interfaces is what makes your classes testable, not the use of a DI container. Notice I didn't use a DI container in my test. I mocked things up and injected them in. You can, I've seen it, I just don't like to. I like to use DI containers in production only. But it's that setup of the code, that the following of the number one, the single responsibility principle. And also, I use Liskov substitution principle, which is kind of a funky way of saying a strategy pattern to inject interfaces. So I've used a couple of solid concepts in order to make my code testable and decoupled. That, to me, is 10 times more important than what comes afterwards. But what comes afterwards is a lifesaver, because now we got to worry about where we're going to new all this stuff up. Okay? And before I go on with this, think of this. You got your commerce class, it's got four dependencies. Now, I just told you to pretend that that billing processor has a couple of dependencies on its own. What if the billing processor has two dependencies, which means all the way back in my program class, I'm instantiating commerce, sending new instances of the four processor classes, and in the new instance of billing processor, I'm sending two new instances of its dependencies. Cool so far? What if later down the road, I want to go to the billing processor and add a third dependency to the constructor? That's what I meant by now I got to take a step backwards and figure out where to new it up. Usually you let the compiler help you with this, because you know all sorts of red funky stuff is going to start showing up all over the place, and you just follow the trail until you fix it. But that's such an ugly thing. That's like what I said on Tuesday. That's the kind of code you write, and then you got to go home and take a shower. Just dirty, dirty code. And man, I've seen some dirty, dirty code. Has anybody here seen stupid stuff in their life that a programmer's written? I'm talking about a manual enum called MyBoolean with true, false, and other. This is the kind of stuff I deal with. But they pay me by the hour to fix this kind of stuff and to ridicule it, so I'm not complaining. All right, so this kind of satisfying a class's dependencies is done with the aid of a dependency injection container, of a product. And that's what a DI container is. And every single DI container is free. I don't think you pay for any one of them out there. And in its simplest form, a DI container is just a repository. It's a bucket of key value pairs. And the key value pairs give you associations of an interface to a class, an interface to a class, an interface to a class. You can get complex. You can get an interface to more than one class, or vice versa. And I'm going to get to some of that stuff later. But in its most simplest form, it's nothing more than a repository of key value pairs, a bucket list, and it provides two primary things, R and R. In the States, you would think that would mean rest and relaxation, but it doesn't. It means registration and resolve. You register your DI container, you build it one time at the beginning of your app. So in a web app, it usually goes in the global ASAX under application start, so it happens one time per application. In a desktop applications, it happens somewhere in the splash screen. You don't have to go and repeat this process. It's a one-time process. Then from there on, the idea is not to new classes up, but instead to ask the container for them. And when you ask the container for a class, this is where the magic begins. Because the container is designed to recursively resolve dependencies, which means if I ask a container, if I register all my classes, like I'll show you in a few minutes, and I ask the container to give me the commerce class, it is going to instantiate the commerce class. But before it instantiates it, it's going to look at that type, and it's going to reflect into the constructor, and it's going to see if it has any interface-based arguments in that constructor. And then it's going to go back to its key value pair list, its repository, and see if there's any associations for those interfaces to classes. So what it's supposed to do is instantiate those classes and plug them into that constructor before it gives us the commerce class instance. But before it does that, it takes each one of those classes and looks in their constructor to see if there's dependencies in there. And it keeps doing this as far down as it needs to go until it doesn't find anything else. And then it starts instantiating the class, plugging it into its parent, into an instantiation of its parent, and plugging that one in and that one in. And by the time we're done and we get the commerce class, It doesn't matter whether we have one level of dependencies or 1,000. And God help you if you ever get 1,000. But it doesn't matter. They'll all be nice and resolved, which is the cool thing about DI containers. And this is the ease that they give us in the resolve process. This is the chain reaction that we start. Now, these are a lot of these are the most popular containers that are out there right now. I already took a poll on what you guys use, but to be honest with you, it was a useless poll. It doesn't matter. It really doesn't. Like I said, I like AutoFact because it's very modern, and I know how to do everything I need to in it. I don't know how to do instance lifetime management in Unity. I know there's a way to do it. I just haven't learned because I don't use Unity. Anybody here use Unity? Anybody know how to do instance lifetime management in Unity? Okay, so it is possible, right? What about the same question for Castle? A couple of hands. So see, it's all possible. I just happen to know how to do it with this one. Unfortunately, MEF is a little more limited. MEF wasn't designed as a DI container. It was designed as a plugin framework that happens to have a container in it. And it works very well as a container. I actually use it in one of my courses. But it does have a couple of other limitations that conventional DI containers give you that MEF does not. All right, so let me show you what these demos are set up as. As you can see by my Solution Explorer, I have demos set up in all those containers. So you can see what some of the demo, what some of the syntax looks like for all those containers. And I'm going to show you one sample of all of them, but then I'm going to stay in AutoFact. Now, I have these demos broken out by different classes, so I don't have to change stuff. The demos are nicely organized, so when you download this code, you'll see that according to the PowerPoint slide, it showed you demo one, which corresponds here to the first demo, and that's broken out into a region here. So every single demo is numbered, and you know how to go back and forth between the slides and the code, okay? Now, what I have here is the same thing. It's the whole commerce thing. But the difference is that I'm going to be using a dependency injection container for it. So my commerce class in this project looks exactly the same as before. It's fully decoupled. I followed some of the solid principles already. What I haven't done is shown you how I'm going to resolve this stuff, how I'm going to satisfy these dependencies. Well, remember I told you that registration process happens once at the beginning. So this is the beginning of my app right here. And this is what I've done to register it. Remember I told you in its simplest form, the DI container is nothing more than a key value pair list. It's a big repository of association pairs. Those associations are an abstraction to a class. So that's what you're looking at there in lines 54 to 58. Four abstractions registered to a class. All this means is when the container is faced with one of these interfaces, it knows what class it needs to instantiate. That's all it is. Now, some containers force you to register any class that is going to undergo any kind of usage of dependency injection, whether it's an interface-based class or not, which is why you see that I'm registering the commerce class in line 54, because I can't perform line 62, container.resolve, on the commerce class if the container doesn't ahead of time know it. Why does that container need to know about it ahead of time? Honestly, I have no clue. I don't, because not all containers force you to do this. Unity doesn't force you to register the commerce. It just lets you resolve the commerce class. You're resolving a concrete class. You're not resolving an interface. If you're resolving an interface, if I say resolve I notification processor, it is going to give me an instance of the notification processor, as the registration on line 57 shows. But I'm asking it to resolve the Commerce One class. So why on earth is it asking me to register it? That's just, I don't know. The guys that wrote AutoFact were smoking certain substances at the time. I'm not really sure. Hey, I've written some of my best code on whiskey, okay? So I'm not gonna judge. I'm not here to judge. Everybody has their own vice, right? I have several actually. So I register my types and I create my container. That code is going to vary from one container to the other. AutoFact separates the container and the builder out into different classes, which is why you see that I'm creating the container builder, and then I'm registering the types off the builder, And then the container gets created with the build method from the build. If I show you this same code in Unity, it's different, but the same. What I mean by that is that you're going to recognize what it's trying to do. See it right there? Line 14 creates the container, and the next four lines register the types, just with a different API, different syntax. And if I show you structure map, actually castle. See? Castle also makes you register the concrete type. And then the registration is some funky, I don't know what that guy was thinking. I mean, some people still think that the more complex you make an API look, the cooler you are, the smarter you are. I go completely the other way around. So this is Unity, and this is Windsor, and let's go back here. All right, everybody with me so far on the registration? I did my registration. It happens to have just four registrations in it, but this can have 400. And in a large application, that is not outside of the realm of possibility. 400 classes, registered interfaces, very possible, very easy to get to that point. Now, I asked the container to resolve the Commerce One class. And by doing that, it's going to undergo that magic recursion process I told you about. It's going to go through and reflect into the constructor, find its dependencies, try to come back to its repository to figure out what those interfaces are associated with. Before it instantiates those classes, it reflects into them, tries to find their dependencies. And if that goes 30 levels deep, so be it, as long as it finds those. If it doesn't find them, it's going to obviously inject a null into there, and some of your code is obviously going to break. But this is the beauty of using a DI for a container for resolving and for registration, is that now I can just list my stuff out in one place and down my object tree whenever I need whenever a class needs a dependency of something else. Let's say, for example, that the logger, I wanted the logger inside the customer processor because somewhere in that code I want to call the logger. Okay? Now, if the logger is registered here, what do you think I have to do to magically use my logger? All I got to do is take the iLogger logging processor and inject it as an additional argument into the constructor of the customer processor or the billing processor. Simply by doing that, the resolve process doesn't change, because next time it resolves, it's going to find that extra dependency and be able to resolve it. And I can't stress to you, for those of you that haven't done this before, I can't stress to you how cool it is and how satisfying it is to be able to do that. As a system grows, I've done this 100 times where I have three or four levels deep into an object hierarchy. I realize that I need to do something else in this method. And there's a class out there that does what I need to do. I need to call upon it. So I need to take reliance on yet another dependency. And all I do is add that dependency to the constructor and run my application and use it in code. And because I registered everything, it all works really, really nicely. So if I were to run this right now, and I'm only going to run this once because every run is going to look exactly the same. I'm not going to bore you, okay? That's what it looks like. Let me blow it up. Remember I told you all my processor classes just write to the console to show you that something took place? That's all it is. So you can see that the process order is calling upon all the dependencies. Okay, any questions? Yes, sir. Okay, hang on one second. Before you ask, was there a mic set up in this room? I guess not. Ask me your question and I'll repeat it. Okay, so the question is, does AutoFac also resolve properties? The answer is absolutely yes. They all do. All the containers do. That is one of the demos that I took out in the interest of time because I don't want to run out of time. Because I already got some crap from some people on the evals about running out of time in my first thing on Tuesday. If you guys are in this room, yeah, come and talk to me in my face, huh? But the answer is yes. And when I get to the end in the usage scenarios, when I get to web forms, you're going to see it in action. I'm not going to detail and have a whole demo about it because it just takes up time and it's not as commonly used as constructor injection. So what this gentleman is talking about is something called property injection, and you saw my dependencies injected as arguments into the constructor. You could also set up those dependencies as public properties of the interface type, have a default constructor, and the container will reflect in and see those public properties and resolve them the same exact way, instead of through the constructor. That's called property injection. Okay, so let's talk about on-demand instances. Let me explain to you what I mean. So sometimes a class receives many, many injections, and depending on the method you're calling in that class, you don't need all of them. Now, you've just undergone a pretty heavy process for something that you're not going to use. Make no mistake about it, instantiation of objects in the .NET framework is not light. It's a price to live. We can't get away from it. But it is not a light process. Anybody that has ever taken any kind of course or read any book about how the CLR works from loading to disposing, and how the garbage collection works, and how the heap and the stack management works, has anybody ever dived around with some of this stuff? It's a heavy process. There's a lot going on there, especially if the heap is full and needs to be compacted and then needs to be garbage collected, because the heap is like a hard drive. It needs contiguous space for an object to be created. And if it's fragmented, it needs to be compacted, which is the equivalent of defragging your hard drive. And all of this happens all the time on your machine while you don't even know about it. But if you bring things down to the nanosecond level, you'll see that it is resource heavy. So if I have a class, and I'll give you an example. Has anybody here watched my Pluralsight course, Building End-to-End Applications? Only two people. What's the matter with you people? You guys all need to watch my Pluralsight course. It'll change your lives forever. Besides, I was the first instructor to use green screen in Pluralsight, so you actually see me in the course, which is kind of cool because I'm so handsome and all, you know? But it's only at the end. It's only all the way at the end. But in that course, and the two guys that raised their hands, and incidentally, if anybody needs a Pluralsight subscription, a 30-day free subscription, send me an email or a tweet after I leave the conference. When I get back to the States, I'll make sure that you get a 30-day key, which is only good for watching my course. Okay? Now, in that course, for those of you that watched it, I have a WCF service that's using some data repositories to access the database. Now, this WCF service has probably 6 or 7 operations in it, reasonable size. And I have a lot of tables. I have like 15 tables in the database. It's small. But depending on the operation, I may need 3 repositories. This one, I may need only 1. This one, I may need 2 of them. But I have to inject the combination of all of those data repositories into the service when I may only be using a limited number of them. This is the kind of instantiation that I don't want to happen. And this is why I use a pattern, which in the course I call it either a service locator or abstract factory. These two patterns are not interchangeable, but loosely we use the term interchangeably because they're very, very similar. The main difference is where the generic goes in the method as opposed to in the class. So if I want to stick to the pattern catalog, this would actually be a service locator pattern. Now, before somebody says something, if it's on the tip of your tongue, I heard that service locator is an anti-pattern. I want you to take a pistol and put it against your forehead right now and pull the trigger. It's not an anti-pattern. I don't care what anybody wrote. I don't care what you read. The minute you start using the term anti-pattern, it just tells me you read a little too much. Service locator works. It works fine. I don't know why a lot of people have a real dislike to it, but it does what it does really, really well, and it solves the problem, and that's the most important thing. If it solved the problem, why do I care that somebody wrote in a book that you shouldn't use this because it's a code smell? Tell them they smell. So let's do a service locator and see what we got going. I want you to take a look at this commerce class. Say what? Huh? Oh. Thanks. So we're on to 6:15, right? Yep. Okay, so what do you see that's different here? My process order is using all 4 processors. But in the future, I may have another method inside the Commerce 2 class. Excuse me. My voice was starting to go yesterday from all the yelling at the party zone. And I may only need 1 of them, or 2. So with the old example, I was injecting all 4 dependencies into the constructor, remember? Now I'm injecting 1 dependency in there. It's called processor locator. And I'm going to use that class, processor locator, to go out and get me instances of my other processors. But I'm not injecting the processor locator because I still need to follow my original rule of writing decoupled software. You write decoupled software by embracing the interfaces. Because if I inject the processor locator, let me show you what the processor locator looks like. processor locator goes out to the container, which is a static variable that's scoped to the entire application. It's very normal. In the web, you put it in an application variable. And it calls a resolve on that T. As simple as that. If I were to inject that class into Commerce, I'm locked into that. What if I don't want to be locked into that? If I'm in a unit test, the unit test is not using a container, which means program.container is going to be null. Hell, the program class is not even going to be accessible to the unit test. So I've abstracted the service locator out, which is why I use the term abstract factory almost interchangeably, because I've abstracted it to the iProcessor locator interface, so I can use that to inject into my hosting class. Now, one of the things that Chris brought up of why people on Wednesday, on why people don't like the service locator, is because, well, then you can use it to create anything. But there's an answer to that problem, too. There's an answer to every problem. And for the right hourly wage, I'll help you find them. iProcessor locator, as you see it right now, will allow me to create any class. But all you got to do is use a constraint. What's to stop me from having my interfaces here? And I think they already do. No, they don't. I can create an interface called iProcessor. It's a marker interface. It doesn't even need any methods. If I create an interface called iProcessor, then I can come here, and here I put a where. T is iProcessor. And now I've just created a generic constraint. So now I've solved the problem of the class being able to instantiate anything. Now that processor locator is designed to instantiate processors only. So you can have many if you want. It all depends on how you want to design your application. So I really don't understand why a lot of people are against using the service locator pattern. Let me show you what it looks like. Because all I did here is add a class to my registration. As you can see in line 75, I'm registering the processor locator to iProcessor locator. When I mock this up later, I can create a mock of the billing processor. I can create a mock of the iCustomer processor. Then I can create a mock of the iProcessor locator. And in the setup, tell it when the get processor is called with the argument iBilling processor, return the mock of iBilling processor. You're using one mock with another now. It's a very normal thing. Who's done this in a mocking framework before? It's actually kind of cool, right? It's that kind of code that you write and you feel really, really geeky. Like you're hoping that there wasn't a woman around to see you. You know what I mean? That kind of nerdiness. But see, we love that kind of nerdiness. And besides, European women think that's hot, right, guys? American women don't. And that's why I married the European women, so. All right. So, any questions on how the service locator works? If you watch my course, this should be familiar to you because you notice I had that data repository. Who are the guys that watch my course? Raise your hands again. You guys remember the data repository factory? Remember the business engine factory? Same exact pattern, just two different factories. And the beauty of this is that if you ever need to swap out containers, something that I think it's a major commitment, so it's easier said than done. But if you need to go from AutoFact to Castle Windsor, you create another one of those service locators that's going, you know, the only thing that's going to change is that resolve statement, maybe a different syntax. Any questions so far? This is way too slow. Okay, here's a beauty, instance lifetime. So by default, containers have an instance lifetime of transient. What transient means is that you get an instance of the class that you asked for. When the container returns a class, it doesn't hold on to it. All it does is return that class to you, and that's it. Which means the lifetime of that class is going to be equatable to the lifetime of the parent, and the parent lets it go whenever it wants to. So for me, all the container did was create that billing processor and the other three processor classes, inject them into the commerce, and when the commerce falls out of spoke and no longer has a stack pointer into the heap, so it's ready for to be collected, the other classes will fall out of scope as well. Why? Very simple .NET, right? There's nothing else left out there with a reference to it. So the container will not keep a reference to it. Now, there's another way of registering a class in a container, and that is the singleton way. It can be very, very useful. It can be very dangerous, just like the quintessential singleton pattern. You be careful with that pattern, because if you don't have proper locking going on, singleton can get you in a lot of trouble. What singleton does is that when you register a class as a singleton, the container will instantiate it upon first usage and hang on to that instance. And the next time somebody requests that class or something requests that class from a container, it will be fed the exact same instance and not recreated again. So you can maintain state in there. Each resolve request results in the exact same instance as I'm about to show you. Now, there's one other thing that throws a wrench into a whole lot of stuff. And this has actually bitten me in the ass in front of a customer, unfortunately, which is usually where you get the most bites. Disposable components. So by default, a DI container that gives you a component, that resolves a class for you, will check to see if that class implements the iDisposable interface. And if it does, it hangs on to an instance of it. It doesn't hang on to it in the context of a singleton. It doesn't give you that class again later when you ask for it from another location. It'll give you a new one. But it's expecting you to call dispose on it, and it doesn't know when you do that manually. So it doesn't want to just release that class. It's really weird, and I'm not 100% sure why these containers are designed that way. I feel perfectly fine just letting the container give me the class and then wash his hands with it and let me take care of the disposability and everything. But it wants to hold on to it, and this causes a problem because it can cause memory leaks. So what you got to do is, if you got a container that can support this, you got to use the feature of that container, which is what I'm going to do with AutoFac. If you don't have a container that supports this, such as in the case of MEF, you need to do some weird sub-container hack where you create a separate temporary container, use that as the one that's going to feed your classes, and then dispose of that container, and that in turn disposes and gets rid of all the classes out there and causes no memory leaks. And it's a pain in the butt. I've never used the pattern myself. There's tons of blog postings out on there. Just, you know, Google or Bing around for it. AutoFac has a facility for doing this. AutoFac lets you resolve its classes using a temporary container. It takes this pattern, this hack pattern, into consideration and formalizes it for us. And I believe Unity and Castle and the others do a variation of it. Does anybody know exactly what I'm talking about and can confirm that they've done this with another container? Which container? Huh? So Ninject does have the ability to do the subcontainer thing for lifetime management? See, they all have one way, you know, some kind of way to do it. I just don't know how the others do it. I'm going to show you how the AutoFac does it. Before I do that, I'm going to show you Singleton first. So let's go back into the code. And here I am I'm registering my classes. And this is the default. That's not the default. I'm sorry. The default is transient. Instance per lifetime scope is what I want to register my classes with if I want to use the disposing trick that I'm about to show you, and which I'm going to in the next demo, which is why I registered them with instance per lifetime scope. Now, I want you to look at this other class here. Single tester. Let's take a look at what single tester is, because my Commerce 3 class right here is injecting the processor locator, no problem. It's getting those processors, it's doing the regular stuff, and then down there, it's using the single tester, which, as you see, is injected up there. It's using single tester to display counter. And what's single tester doing? it's down here. So there's single tester. And all it's doing is displaying the counter to the console. But as you can see, it's a class-wide variable, not a method-wide variable. So if we get a new instance every time, that's always going to be one. If we get a shared instance, it's going to increment. So in here, I'm not doing anything that's abnormal. So I'm going to go ahead and run this and run demo 3. And I'm going to blow it up for you and let you see what took place. Now, as you can see, The counter inside single tester is one up there. Then I ran through my process again, and the counter is still one. That's because I'm getting just a regular transient instance. Once I'm done with it, the container's not holding on to it. Now, if I wanted to turn that into a singleton, once again, every container does this through different syntax, but they all have this feature. And in the case of AutoFac, it's just a registration doohickey at the end that looks like this, single instance. Now, when I run this, and I run it again, and as you can see, the counter increments to 2, which means I'm not getting a new instance of that single tester. I'm getting the exact same instance. If you use MEF, and I know a lot of people raise their hands with MEF, by default, when you export a type in MEF, the default registration in the MEF container is going to be a single instance. So MEF defaults to singleton, and you will forget, I do it all the time when I use MEF, to put the part creation policy attribute on there for non-shared, and that's how you tell it, don't do a single instance. So MEF kind of does it backwards. It defaults to the one that I don't think should be the default. Now, this other thing, the disposability. None of my classes, billing processor, customer processors, none of them implement iDisposable. And I'll tell you right now, if you're one of those programmers that thinks that every class needs to implement iDisposable because it's a cool pattern and Microsoft put it there for a reason, get out of that mindset. iDisposable is there for one reason. That is, if your class deals with unmanaged resources that need to be manually housekept and not through the traditional .NET CLR, then you implement that pattern. Because that's where the garbage collector knows to call the dispose method and manually do your house cleaning there. But if all you're using is .NET managed classes with no unmanaged code whatsoever, there's no reason to implement the iDisposable pattern. There really isn't. Now, notice what I'm doing here. First of all, you notice that I injected a different processor locator in there. Did anybody catch that? It's iProcessor Locator 2. Let me show you what iProcessor Locator 2 looks like. So if I go back to my program, what's that registered to? iProcessor Locator 2, processor locator 2. Let's go there. Now notice this one is doing something a little different. Instead of just simply resolving, when this processor locator is instantiated, I go and create something that AutoFac gives me. And like I said, the other containers do this. They just do it a little differently. I'm telling AutoFac, create this temporary scope using begin lifetime scope. And this is where I'm going to resolve from. You notice my resolve statement on line 23 is not from program.container. It's from scope. That's created when the processor locator is created. By having this temporary container, now the hosting class has something to call on line 28 to release the scope. And when I release that scope, I dispose of my temporary container. When I dispose the temporary container, any disposable objects that the container decided to hold on to for me that will cause a potential memory leak later will get completely disposed. So of course, this puts one little more responsibility in my hands, and that is I have to remember to call release scope. There's no way around that. But because I abstracted everything out, my iProcessor Locator 2 is an interface, which can be mocked later. Later in a unit test, it doesn't matter what I do. In a unit test, I can tell it what to get when the get method is called, and then I can tell it do absolutely nothing when release scope is called, because I'm going to mock all this up anyway. So as long as I'm abstracted, I can tweak and modify this at mocking time to do whatever I want. But I do have to remember to do something like this to release the scope. Without this, you end up with memory leaks. And this causes a problem if you're a WCF developer and you're injecting proxies into, for example, MVC controllers, which I do it all the time. I do it in my course. Because proxies, WCF proxies, all inherit from a class called Client Base of T. And Client Base of T is the proxy class that takes care of all of the low-level protocol negotiation in the world of WCF. That is all unmanaged code in there, which is why proxies need to be disposed. So because the Client Base of T is a disposable class, all your proxies are disposable classes. They implement the iDisposable interface. If you didn't know that, you know it now. Which means if you're incorporating them in DI usage like I do, you got to make sure that they're properly disposed. Otherwise, every time you run your site and your controller instantiates, your DI container instantiates a proxy for your controller and you use it, when that controller goes away and the person's got the web information in front of their face, the server is still hanging on to the instance of that proxy. And the next request will get a new one, and it'll just build up and cause a memory leak. So something to, very important to keep track of. Any questions? All right. We did that. OK, so registration can get to be a little bit of a pain in the butt, because you saw me register 4, 5, 6 classes maybe. No big deal there, but it'd be nice. What if you have 150 classes to register? Well, if you have conventions in your organization, and everybody should, and I honestly don't care what they are, just have them and follow them. If you have some kind of naming conventions, a lot of containers provide help with this. So for example, all of my data repositories all end with the suffix data repository. All of my WCF services end with the word manager. They all implement service contracts that are the same name as the manager, but have a suffix of service instead. So there's naming conventions that I follow. All of my proxy classes are the same name as the service contract, but with the suffix client instead, and obviously without the I, because they're not an interface. So if you have these naming conventions set up and you're very diligent and strict about following them and using them, and of course making sure your developers don't run rampant and they're using them as well, you can get a lot of help in the registration process using the Fluent API of a lot of these containers. And they all do this. AutoFact does it kind of cool with Lambda expressions. And Lambda expressions are one of those things that once you have them, you're just a cooler person, right? And you will get them. Does anybody here not fully understand Lambda expressions? OK, see, I didn't. But somebody once advised me that, you know, unlike women, I will eventually understand them if I just keep at it. And I ended up understanding Lambda expressions. And now I can't get enough of them. They're cool as heck, and I do some really funky stuff with them. Well, I'm going to show you what AutoFact does so you don't have to list out all your registrations one line at a time. Which one is this? 4 and 5. So let's go into demo 4 and demo 5. So demo 4 does something called assembly scanning, which is really cool. So here what it's doing is that I'm registering the single type commerce 4 like I did before, but now I'm registering assembly type. So I'm telling AutoFact, go into that assembly, and it can be any assembly you need, go into that assembly and look for types that end with the word processor, take that class, and register it to an interface that is the same name as that type but starts with the letter I. Why does this work? Because that's the way I name, that's the naming standard that I'm following. But you can put any kind of code formula in there. Now, this looks like it's more code than the previous example of 4 separate registrations. But what happens if I start adding processors? If I add 100 of them, that never has to change. Simply by naming things the right way, they'll automatically get picked up if you're doing something like this. Now, AutoFact also lets you break this stuff up, so you can do module usage. Now take a look at this code. Here, I'm saying register module, processor registration module, and then build a container. I can take all my registrations, whether they're individual registrations or registration of assembly types or any kind of registrations, I can take them all and I can package them in different classes just for my own reusability. So there's the processor registration module. This code should look familiar to you. It's exactly the same as the previous example. It's just put away in another class. AutoFact has a module using the same technology. It has a module whose job it is to go out to the configuration file, config, and look up the registration list there, where you set it up, the types and the interfaces in configuration. I believe Chris showed you something similar with Unity on Wednesday, where it was doing that. You can go to an XML file. Well, it's just leveraging the module technology. You know, it's got a built-in module where the code that's right there just opens up a config file and looks for the registrations and then performs all the registrations. So it's a nice way of breaking up the application, of bringing up the registration. Any questions? Okay, so I always get this question when I do any kind of DI talk. Okay, but what if I have more than one registration, more than one class to that interface? What do I do there? Well, there's two scenarios that call for those one-to-many. One of them is that at runtime, you're going to need one of potentially several instances of an interface implementation. If that's your scenario, all dependency injection containers allow you to register interface to classes and then give them a name, give them a string name, an identifier. You can use that identifier later to grab a specific instance. I try to avoid scenarios like that. I just feel really dirty about that. If I have an interface called iPlugin, I don't want to purposely target either plugin 1, plugin 2, plugin 3 in different parts of my app. If that's what I find myself doing, I need different interfaces. If I have iPlugin, my common scenario, and I find this to be 99% of the time, people's most common scenario, is that I need every implementation of that interface to be returned to me. So then I can loop through them and execute them. And when you do that in AutoFac, as with every other container out there, it's very, very easy. So if I go to demo 6, you'll notice that I'm injecting in there iPostOrder plugins into a variable called plugins. But I'm not injecting iPostOrder plugins. I'm injecting an enumerable of it. Because then later down here, in line 34 through 38, 37, I'm just looping through my plugins and calling to do something. And the registration on that is very easy, because it's exactly the same as what you saw. It's just registering the interface to a type, the interface to a type. In fact, I use the lambda expression technique here, where I can say, register from that assembly, anything that starts with the word plugin, register it to that one interface. And that's how I wind up with multiple classes registered to that one interface. And 99% of the time, I want all of them. If I really do want just one of those things, I probably have the wrong design in there somewhere. And if I were to run that, there you can see plugin 3, 2, and 1 executed at the bottom. And the last part here is kind of cool. And I don't know 100% if every container supports this. I know that AutoFac does. I know Unity has a way to do it as well. And I am willing to bet that the others do as well. I just have no idea how they do it. AutoFac does it really nicely. Meth does this very nicely, because Meth is attribute-based. To some people, that's one of the drawbacks of Meth. To me, it's one of the strengths of Meth. I like attribute-based. I like that explicitness. I like to see the class and know what's going on there. And Meth forces you to identify the constructor that you want to incorporate in the dependency injection with an attribute called importing constructor. If you don't do that, Meth's not going to use that constructor. Now, AutoFac and all the other containers decide in their own way which constructor they're going to use. AutoFac and Unity, I know for a fact, will use the constructor with the most number of arguments, if you happen to have more than one constructor. I believe either Ninject or Castle or StructureMap, one of those three uses the first constructor it finds. So they all have their own little magic formula for determining what constructor. But I like the ability to have deterministic constructor injection, because I may have one constructor for testing, one constructor for production. And sometimes the one with the most arguments is not the one that I want to use in dependency injection, for whatever stupid reason. I want to have the choice. So every container offers the ability to do this, to figure out a way to target a specific constructor. And the way AutoFac does it is with something called a constructor finder. Now, if I run this right now, notice I'm registering my commerce type, commerce 7, And you can do this too. If your constructor contains non-interface types, but regular types, and you know what the value should be at registration time, you can target them. It's rare that that happens, but it is possible. So here, my constructor in my Commerce 7 is going to have A, B, C, and D variables. So if I go to Commerce 7, you'll see a constructor with A, B, C, and D. And then you'll see the other constructor, which is very obvious to you already. Now, which constructor is this going to use by default based on what I told you? It's going to use that second one. So if I run this now, notice it used that constructor, which means I'm kind of SOL here. Do you guys know what SOL means, or is that only for Americans? What does SOL mean? Okay, S out of luck. And I'm not going to say S because this is Microsoft and it's being recorded and I don't want to get canned. But yes, the S stands for what you're thinking. So look what happens now. If I continue, now I'm here. Processor locator is null. This is going to completely fail. So I need to somehow tell it that it needs to target a specific constructor. And the way AutoFact does that is with something called a constructor finder. The constructor finder is a class that you write that implements the iConstructor finder. And here you do whatever you want because your type comes into there. So now all I'm doing is that I'm getting the constructors out of the type and I'm going through whatever magical formula I want to implement to target a specific constructor. To me, the cleanest way to do it is to find a constructor that has a specific attribute. I wrote this attribute here. Call awesome constructor attribute that does absolutely nothing. But because that's what my constructor finder is looking for, I am now able to decorate my constructor. Is it seven? Seven. I'm now able to decorate my constructor like this. And then when I declare all this stuff, I can tell it, find constructors with this awesome constructor finder. And now by registering it like that, oops. As you can see, it hit the right constructor this time. And by hitting the right constructor, now when I go here, my processor locator should not be null. And it is not. And my code will work. So that deterministic constructor identification is a very important thing. It really helped me out a lot in a project that I was on because the developers wrote several constructors into some of their dependencies. And some of them were for testing only and had a lot more arguments than the production constructor. And we needed a way to solve this problem. So luckily, the containers do allow you to solve the problem. I don't know how my laptop got unplugged. All right, any questions? So I'm going to show you some usage scenarios, OK? And let's go back to the PowerPoint real quick. And we have, good, we got like 7 or 8 minutes, which is exactly what I need. An extra minute for the slide transition, of course. OK, so I got some sample apps set up just to leave you with some real-world use. I try to do this on Tuesday. And again, I apologize that I had to rush to that part at the end. But I strongly encourage you to look at that before and after example that I showed you in the MBVM talk, because I really did want a little more time for that. And it's important. And the same thing for this. I not always get to this point, but I've cut things out of the session so I can put some importance on this. And these are usage examples in the different applications that I think everybody in this room writes. So I use WPF quite a bit. I'm a WPF guy. But this will all work with Silverlight and WinRT. And I use DI here to resolve my view model classes. So I have a view model that gets resolved by the DI container. But that view model contains a couple of other view models inside of it. And they're injected into the primary view model using dependency injection. So the container will automatically resolve those second view models for me just by me asking for the first one. Now, when you're dealing with view models, who's a WPF developer? All right, when you're dealing with view models and subview models and subview models like that, which is very, very common, contained view models, most people, usually out of laziness, and I'm guilty of this too, will not start using interfaces all over the place there. It's rare that I see people abstracting view models out to interfaces. But it is very handy if you do that. It's just a lot more work. And I did that in my examples, so you can study them on your own, where my view models are all abstracted to an interface, and that's what I'm injecting into the parent view model. So I'm going to show you that example. I'm going to show you an MVC example where a service that is going out to get data is abstracted to an interface, and that's the interface that gets injected into my controllers. And what you got to do in MVC and Web API is set up a dependency resolver so that the doohickey, the code behind the scenes that goes out and creates a controller for you by default, gets overridden with a piece of code that says, go get it from the container. Because now you're registering your controllers and you're registering everything else, and by MVC using this dependency resolver to get you a controller from a container, then anything the container depends on will get injected automatically as well. So this is very common. 90% of people that I find out there that are using MVC are using some form of DI, unlike this one. Web forms. You gotta love web forms, huh? This is the animal that just refuses to die. And that's why I love it. I was an old web forms developer. I made my name in the community in America by being known as the web control guy. I was big time into developing custom web control. So I still have a lot of love for web forms. Very misunderstood technology. But most people will tell you web forms can't incorporate DI. Well, that's only partial truth. Web forms can certainly undergo dependency injection. What they can't undergo is testing very easily, because the code behind in a web form cannot be instantiated on its own. It requires this virtual class that gets created by ASP.NET that is a C# representation of the ASPX page. And those two compiled together make up the actual page. So by itself, the code behind is only half the stuff. Whereas in MVC, a controller is just an independent C# class that can be instantiated by a unit test with no problem whatsoever. So we still have the testability problem in web forms, but we can incorporate it into dependency injection. And the last example I got for you is WCF. Now, WCF was a tricky one at one point because you had to jump through some hoops to do things. And in fact, the way I do it in my course is not the way I'm going to show you here, because I don't use AutoFac in my course. I regret it now, but it is what it is and still works fine. But WCF wants to be the technology to create the class for you. It wants to manage that service class. Yet I just told you, we want the container to do that. Well, AutoFac has a behavior that you can inject into a WCF host that intercepts that process, the instantiation process. So when WCF says it's time for me to create the service, let me go to the container to get it. So all four of these technologies can benefit from dependency injection. Like this. Now, I'll run through this quickly, so not to keep you here, even though this is the last session of the day. Here is AutoFac WPF. Here's my view models. This is my main window view model. And this is the only one, that I am going to be creating manually by going to the container. This is the top of the heap, so I'm going to the container and saying, get me IMA window view model. Hopefully it's been associated with something, and take that something and stick it in the data context. And any sub stuff that's in there should automatically be resolved for me just by doing this statement. And this is what the main window view model looks like. As you can see, it's abstracted to the iView model, and it has iCustomer list view model injected into it and iCustomer view model injected into it. And then there's a bunch of other stuff going on in here. I'm not going to get into any of this MVVM stuff right now. But by me asking the container to resolve a view model, any subview models that it depends on will automatically get resolved, which is very, very nice. And if I go to the customer view model, which I know is what the iCustomer view model is associated to, see, there's the interface, there's the class. Notice it has a dependency. Now I'm two levels deep. This is the example I told you about at the beginning, but I didn't have it in code. Now I have it in code. So I got the main view model, depends on the customer view model. Customer view model depends on the iCustomer repository. And that is going out to get some kind of a database thing, right, to show on the screen. So then, at the beginning of my application, in my app.xaml.cs file, I'm registering all my stuff. There's my view model registrations. There's my customer repository registrations. I could use the Lambda technique here. I can do whatever I want. when I run this, you'll see that the screen shows. It shows me the customer list view. That's one view model inside the main one. I can toggle it to show the other view inside the main one. I can toggle back. And all I had to do was ask it for the first one. So very, very common techniques in WPF. MVC works like this. You got your controller, home controller. As you can see, the controller has a dependency injected into its constructor. And that's the dependency that I'm going to use to get the customers on line 25 and then return a view. This same technique can be used for web API, of course. In the global ASAX, I'm doing my registration in the application start. There's all my registration stuff for the container. And then I'm setting the resolver. Now, sometimes you have to write your own resolver. That's a very easy thing to do. But nowadays, most containers already have a NuGet package out there for it. So there's a NuGet package called AutoFact for MVC5. There's one for web. There's no web forms, but there's MVC5. There's one for web API. There's one for MVC4, so they have different versions. There's a Castle for MVC. There's a Ninject for MVC. And all they are dependency resolvers that the author has already written. So you can just set the resolver right here. And that's going to be the interception point so that when you ask, when the controller needs to be instantiated, MVC will go to the dependency injection container to get it instead of instantiating it on its own, instead of instantiating it without it. And now when I run this, you'll notice that I'll have some links. I can hit this. There's my list of customers. And there's my customer one. And all of that just hit this home controller right there. There's the customers, and there's the customer one. And they're both using the customer repository to get that data that I just put on the screen, which means that that service got successfully injected. As far as WebForms is concerned, WebForms gives you a couple of options, and I favor one of them because it's easy and it works in Visual Studio IIS Express. One of them is a customer factory, the other one is not. And this is where, who was the gentleman that asked me about property injection? Okay, so this is where you're gonna see property injection. So here's the customer ASPX page. There's my page load. And my page load is getting a query string and showing a data grid and doing some binding, right? But it needs that customer repository, just like my previous examples did. And that customer repository cannot go into constructor because the page handler factory needs to be able to do its magic to use this in conjunction with the ASPX page and build the page that it's going to render. So I can't mess with that constructor. I will completely screw the entire world of ASP.NET up. It's like crossing the streams, if you know what that means from Ghostbusters. Everybody knows crossing the streams? American pop culture logic always falls short when I'm on stage in Europe. So the important thing is that the customer repository is a public property. This is what the gentleman was asking about when he said property injection. It's declared as a custom property. And if you look at the base class here, it's not the page class like you're used to seeing. It's a class that I wrote called page base. And page base overrides the onInit, goes to get the container that I've built in the global ASAX and put into an application variable, and then tells the container, inject the properties into this, this being the page that I'm in because this is the base class. And that little process right there is going to kick off the resolve process with those public properties. Does that answer your question now? So this one will work exactly the same. The other technique is a page handler factory, which you must run in classic ASP.NET mode in IIS for this to work. So what I do is that I write a custom page handler factory that inherits from the default and goes out and builds the page the way ASP.NET's designed to build it, just by calling the base, and then does an inject into it. And then I got to install this in the HTTP handlers, and it becomes a pain in the butt. I like the base class technique a lot better. And the last one is WCF. And WCF, if you look at the program class here, I have a service. Let's look at the service. This is a WCF service implementing a WCF service contract. It's got an operation there called perform operation that is saying call a method called show to console of dependency. What's dependency? It came in using the iDependency interface in the constructor. So normally, WCF will have a problem with this because it tries to new up the class with its own instance provider. And it's not expecting this constructor. But once again, AutoFact has a package called AutoFact for WCF, and the other containers have the same, which just lets you add a behavior. So if you can see, I'm opening my host on line 23, and into that host, I'm adding the DI behavior. And by adding the DI behavior, I just told WCF, when you need to instantiate that class, and you don't know what it needs to, that all depends on your instance mode. If you're a WCF person, then per call, per session, singleton means something to you. So that's going to depend when the instancing takes place. And whenever it takes place, it just knows to go through the container now. And by going through the container, it is able to resolve those constructors. And that is why, if I look at that component, which has this text that was outputted from a dependency injection container, I'm going to run this. This runs my host. I'm going to press enter to call the operation. And as you can see, there is the text. This text was outputted from the dependency injection container. So there you got the four usage examples for all four applications. And I think I went over probably 3 or 4 minutes. 4 minutes, five minutes. So I apologize. I don't have much else for you except some closing statements. So remember, the core principle of testable code is the uses of the interfaces, the decoupledness, the first part of that solid talk that you saw by Chris yesterday. The single responsibility, the substitution principle, those things are important to write testable software. And to set yourself up for DI using the divergent-dependent inversion principle, which is the last part of SOLID. The next part is how you resolve all that stuff. And that's where the product comes in. That's where the container comes in. They all have different features, but they all do essentially the same thing, just in a different way. But the container does not facilitate testing. The concepts do. So this is a great, great book. This is almost like a manual for every DI container out there. This guy's got a chapter for everything, including AutoFact, Math, Spring. So it's almost like a how-to for all the containers. And that's all I got for you guys. Please fill out an eval form for me. If you haven't filled out an eval form for my talk on Tuesday, please fill one out. If you haven't filled out an eval form for Chris's talk yesterday, please help us out. We really need to have this feedback. And hopefully, with that feedback, we'll see you again. If you want a 30-day Pluralsight subscription, please email me or Twitter me. Just say, I was at your class in Europe. Can you please send me a 30-day subscription? And I'll be more than happy to set you up. And then you can watch my course and be a lot smarter for it. Thanks for coming, guys.